Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about the soul. What is it? What is it not? We look back and we say, I remember, I'm in my 60s, I remember in the 50s when we had religion, it was all about the catechism, whatever Catholic Church said, and you had to memorize and spit it back out. Was there really any conversation about the soul, the spirit? And we're talking about spirituality. What is the conversation going on? How does it reflect into religion? How does it take us out of it? But also, too, how does it bring us back to who are we? What are we? Are we our legacy with all the letters behind our name? Or is it really something that we are saying, oh, my gosh, you know, a storm came along, it took all my stuff, and what am I going to do? There's no me anymore. Are we losing our identity? Or is it perhaps that false sense of identity? Who are really keeping our soul? How does our soul evolve? What does that really mean? And does it really get old? Do we just have one lifetime? All of these great questions we'll be talking about today. My guest is Thomas Moore. His book is Ageless Soul, The Lifelong Journey Towards Meaning and Joy. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thomas, don't you think, you know, if we look back on the decades in history and we say, would we have this conversation today? Wow, even maybe just two decades ago, do you think?
Well, this conversation has been going on for centuries, but we live in a time when we've forgotten about many of these things, and we tend to focus on numbers and take things literally. So conversations about the soul are pretty rare these days.
Yeah, and also, too, I think that it might have been in secular groups they might have been having these conversations, you know, a lot of esoteric kind of conversations. But really, we look at it and we say, has it really come forefront? And I think now, almost any time you could hear the word soul or spirit or evolution or all of these changes or spirituality, where before it would be pretty much kind of not really discussed. They really wanted to know, you know, who was getting a car, how everything was going, and, oh, what school are your kids going to? It was more of that conversation. So I think we are evolving, don't you think?
I do. I do think so. And as we evolve, we go through dark periods. And one thing I've noticed, because I've studied the history of soul over a long period of time, and what I find is that in the very difficult times historically and politically, those are the times when the most fruitful work on soul has been made and accomplished. So I'm looking forward to our particular time today, because these days the world is in kind of bad shape, as everyone is aware and feels, and yet it's a very fruitful time to be talking about these things that matter so much.
You know, it really does, because people will say, oh my gosh, and they'll go off on the conversations, you know, of whatever's going on in the world, and I'll say, oh, okay, I hear you, but now let's look at the other side of it. You know, someone will say something to me. They'll say something like, oh, my gosh, my car broke down. It was the worst day ever, you know. I'm going to get fired. And then I turn around and say, okay, so you're telling me maybe you needed a rest and you're not quite in the place you should be and looking for another job is the greatest thing? And they go, what? So I think sometimes that is true, because what happens is when these things arise, then it's an opportunity for us to say, I don't think I want to even engage in that. I don't want to choose to live like that. Perhaps maybe I'm so glad they brought it to the forefront, and now we can learn something different and how to do something better. Don't you think it's really giving, it's almost like handing someone an empty box and saying, fill it up with the potentials versus, you know, saying, let's keep dragging the old ball and chain around, right?
Yes. We do have to be careful with it, that there is a tendency in among spiritual groups to avoid, you know, what's happening in the world, to kind of focus on the kind of visions of perfection and how wonderful things could be. So we have to be careful that we don't do that. We don't want to avoid facing the issues that are around us. But that doesn't mean that you can at the same time, and maybe using the anxiety that you have in the moment, to use it for more positive means, to spur you on to realize what is ultimately really important. So what we do, I think, at the, in the best circumstances is do both of those things. We're sensitive to what's happening in the world and concerned very much. And our ethics is very, very strong, our sense of what's moral and our own personal ethics. On the other hand, we can then expand our vision and look more creatively at a bigger picture.
You know, Thomas, your book really, again, Ageless Soul, is really about how can we connect with our ageless soul while living in a limiting, aging physical body. You know, I think sometimes people say, you're really talking about all of this, things go on forever and all of that, but, you know, it's okay, but I can't seem to get up off the couch, and, man, I really wish I could jog with my granddaughter. You know, I think so we're having a lot of these conflicts of the words, but really we are having a lot of stuff coming up in our heart that we really want to express. Do you think?
Absolutely. It's very important to get the feelings about the bad side of growing old, to get them out of the way, in a sense, to express them, to be heard, to be sure that people know that it isn't all easy and fun. There are many, many difficult aspects to getting older, and the physical side is really probably most prominent. On the other hand, once you admit, once you discuss that and say this is what's happening, then you can look at another side of it that is more positive, because there are very good things associated with getting older and with aging.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I know for myself, I keep seeing people jogging, and it's like, oh, my gosh, I just really want to feel like I can do that again, you know. But, you know, even walking maybe a few miles, it's like, I don't think so. So, you know, we just really, I guess we kind of, we feel like ourselves, we just wish we could get that other piece that maybe our physical body would go along for the ride too, right?
Yes, I know. It's I feel that. I'm 77. And, you know, I'm doing well, but I wish I could do things that I did 20 years ago. That's certainly true. But, you know, it's just you're participating. I feel like I'm participating in the human experiment. You know, human beings do this. And it would be weird if I didn't get a little weaker as I got older. That would be strange. So I just take it on and then go from there.
You know, in your chapter, you talk about the fleeting of youth, you know. I really look at our existence in life. It's almost like when we're younger, we want to expand out. We want to go out and see. We want to go out and do. You know, we want to go out and collect. We want to go out and be, you know, and collect all this identity stuff. But then as we get older, it's on the other side where we're really exploring more of within. It's just the opposite. You know, we start giving away our things. They aren't important anymore. Other things become more important to us, and we find that deeper connection. It's almost like it's a real full circle, right?
I agree completely. I think that's a very important point. If we could, if we get grasp that, what you just said would be very helpful, because as we get older, I think we have a kind of natural spirituality. It's a natural older spirituality that you don't have to work hard at. Because you do become more contemplative, you do reassess your values almost naturally. You may be motivated and moved to help people more, to especially to give to the young. So there's a spiritual element in us, I think, that rises to the surface. And it's quite natural. You don't have to be part of any particular religion or movement in order to have it, because it just rises right out of who you are.
Yeah, because, I have four kids, 27 to 37, and you look at it and you say they're really trying to find their identity. And they're really their identity they're attaching to the outside. But then when you go along, you find out that your identity is not dependent upon the outside. So really everything is a flux and flow, don't you think?
Yes. When you're young, I don't think it's all about the external world and finding your way out there in the world. It is certainly, that is certainly an important part of being young. And there's a drivenness about it. And young people are very focused. They do have a sense of immortality that the older people don't have. So it is a very special time. On the other hand, I'm very interested in the fact that many of our spiritual teachers and guides over the centuries have been young people. For example, I quote John Keats, a wonderful poet who not only wrote poetry but wrote these long letters that are full of wisdom about being a human being. And he wrote them when he was 23, and he died when he was 26. So there we have someone who's young and yet is doing this inner work at a very intense level.
You know, it's also to the idea that people live a lot longer now than they used to before. You know, when you, in your chapter, you're talking about processing life experiences, about, a woman who, she finally said, about being in a relationship where, finally can you give up the pattern? And I really write down, I think sometimes when we do things in life, it's almost about we like write a chapter, and then we write in, and you know how when people say, oh, well, you always keep doing the same thing over again and over again. And I say, no, with each person, I learn something different. To each experience, I learn something different. I'll let you know when I'm done with the chapter. And then I can go on to the next one, I think sometimes we want to rush and say it must be broken and I have to fix it, where really you're just kind of out there experiencing what's there for the taking. And then, when you're done, you'll close the book and you'll change the title and you'll go to the next thing, right?
I think so. Also, I think sometimes we expect really big dramatic changes, but very often, small developments have a big effect. So you may not notice that things are different, but you may just have an insight somewhere, or you may discover somewhere along the line you can do things a little bit differently, and that can make all the difference.
Right. And and don't you think, though, there's really no right or wrong? I think we want to demonize our existence, and saying, oh, I made a mistake, oh, I took the wrong road, or, oh my gosh, it's a poor choice. And we kind of like want to be walking around slapping our hands. I mean, I can remember, I'm left-handed, and I remember the nuns at school used to hit my hand all the time with a ruler because you're supposed to write right-handed, And I kind of like have that reflection all the time, is that when people would say, I made a mistake, I'm going, oh my gosh, did you get hit on the hand with a ruler, It's sort of, why are we doing that?
What you said originally there about people being upset with themselves for what they've done or haven't done, that really is, it's kind of a reverse egotism, It's like if you're going to blame yourself, it's still focusing too much on yourself. And I think if you could live a life where you don't have to have that focus on your own self so much, and pay attention to life and follow the hints of what you should do and how you should be that life gives you, then I think that's the whole idea of a spiritual existence, is that you respond and you follow rather than create it yourself. And this idea of judging yourself all the time is kind of a reverse form of taking charge and taking credit for everything and taking all the blame.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family. clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Thomas, you also talk about reflection in the book. You know, I've always used the words for reflection. I always call it romancing the past, you know. It's almost like dancing with an illusion created by the mind, you know. And sometimes when we say reflection, we almost aren't sure quite what the truth or the truth is not, because it really doesn't matter. We kind of are just living in the moment anyway. So can you share what your thoughts are on reflection? What is it? Why is it important, or is it not?
Well, I do think reflection is very important. But what we're doing when we remember, I think, is a little bit like looking in a mirror. The image is present. I mean, the past is present to us when we reflect on it. So it's not just looking at things of the past. We are in the present, considering who we are in relationship to who we have been. So I think it's a very good thing to reflect. I know we can get too caught up in the past. I understand that. I personally don't want to live always in the moment, in the present. I think the past is really very important to us, to reflect on it, to keep talking about it. Our dreams take us into the past regularly. I think that's a good sign that there's something that's refreshing and rejuvenating about having conversations about things that happened long ago.
But it also is our validity. You know, I mean, a lot of times, you know, I work with a lot of end-of-life clients, and they love to share stories because it really gives validation to that their life well lived, you know. And I think that that's the most important thing, is to be able to share that and say, you know, this is all the things I've done and I've been and places I've been, and, you know, and they want to share their heart. It's their way of sharing their heart by telling their story. Do you think?
Absolutely. The stories are themselves so very important. A story, in a way, takes a slice of your life, and the beginning and end of the story, how you decide to tell it, where you start, where you finish. It gives some art to your telling, and it takes a piece of your life where you can look at it and see some meaning in it. And I think we have a great hunger for meaning. So telling the stories of our life is a way of creating a situation where you can actually discover the meaningful side of your experience.
You know, I think we're getting to a like rough time right now where I'm finding, you know, since the internet came out and Amazon, you know, anybody could write a book, anybody could put stuff out in print. And a lot of people, a lot of authors have said to me, and even for myself, I've written a lot of things, and they said, well, what is the point? There's no linear progression here. There's no this, there's no that. And I said, but it's my story in my way. And I think to be able to feel that and be able to express it your own way is something that is like almost like a golden coin, you know? And I think sometimes people are afraid to, because they say, well, that's the way it's supposed to be done, and no one wants to hear it the other way. And, you know, I've had people write about breast cancer, and I've had the full gamut, everything from, you know, the nice and the quiet and the peaceful and do this, 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 and this, to the other, oh, it was absolutely the most horrific thing, and let me tell you my story. And I think really all of the stories in between is everybody has something that they want to say, and putting it down, and sometimes in print or out in words, on radio and books, is really sharing a story. And even, you know, I have some friends that had their relatives had Alzheimer's, and it was like, let's record, let's just talk, I'll record. It's almost about just being able to feel like when you can't see them anymore physically, you want to be able to touch something of them. And maybe you could touch their words or touch their voice. Do you think that helps sometimes?
It helps. It helps tremendously for us to share our reflections, the meanings that we find in our own lives, because those meanings can be useful to somebody else, because maybe they haven't considered that before, mm-hmm. what they find out from you. I feel that as a writer myself. I've spent the past 30 years doing nothing but writing, pretty much, and talking mm-hmm. about the writing. So I have to face that and say, does this make a life worth living to write so much? And I feel it does, because it's a form of communicating with people all over the world and being part of the community and making a very small contribution. I think this is another important aspect of what you're saying. We each have to make our contribution, but it doesn't have to be huge, because there's so many of us. And if we just imagine all of us together contributing something, because we each have our own experience and our own way of looking at things, then I think what we have is created a web. I don't mean a worldwide web. I mean kind of a web of fantasy and memory and reflection for all of us. And that's part of, I think that's part of what it means to be part of the human community. We contribute in small ways.
Right. Let's talk for a second about your chapter on illness as an initiation. I've been in healthcare for 45 years, and I've seen everything and anything, including, autopsies all the way up to heart surgery to delivering babies. So I think I have so many varied experiences, and my heart and soul and spirit can go in a bazillion different ways. So when we talk about illness and what does that really do, I think sometimes illness, and it depends on the varying degree of how it impacts your life or your quality of life, is really about what hits you and you say, is my mortality being challenged here? I think almost that people will say, is this the knock on the door, or is this the trap door that's going to open and I'll fall through? I think sometimes that's what takes you to your knees and you say, what is it all about? And do you think that sometimes that's where the conversation starts?
That's what I mean by initiation, really. Initiation is a passage from one level of life to the next. I mean, you go through a passage, and it might be sickness. I mean, sickness is probably one of the great passages we all go through, especially if it's more serious.
Right.
That doesn't have to be, but it might be. And so it does cause us to reflect, I think, on what's important and what we want to do with our lives and about our relationships. I think when people get sick, if they only had an opportunity to tell more, to talk more about what they're going through internally, not just physically, but also internally, we'd realize that sickness is not a physical experience. See, I'd go so far as to say that a human being can never have a purely physical experience. We are never purely biological, ever. So that means that these experiences of illness are part of a meaningful life, and we can look at them that way and say, what do I have to take from this, and how can it place me further along in my discovery of who I am and what I'm to do with this life I have.
I'm going to go right back to the beginning of the book where you talk about your own heart issues and, about being, I think that, and I've seen it repeatedly, is that when people have issues with their heart, it's really about they're settling into the exploration of you. In other words, when you have a heart issue and people say, I went in and I had something fixed on my heart, and people come out and they're changed. And it could be a varying degree of how they could be changed. Anything from their life turns out wonderful and they just go on and they're running in treadmills, or it turns around and then they turn around, they're depressed or whatever that might be. But it really doesn't matter, because what it is when we have a heart surgery, it's really about opening the physical heart to be able then allow the flow of the emotional or the energetic or the vital force back into the heart. You know, sometimes people miss the idea that when you say, oh, I'm really worried, and you look at them and they're clenching their hands, they're rolling forward, they're really shutting off their physical being. And sometimes when people have heart issues, it's really about you're closing yourself off to not feel certain parts of yourself because you're doing other things. So the essence of really who your soul and your spirit is located generally in the heart area. So many people, when they have these heart issues, you know, is really about being able to shock it and say, ooh, okay, so now, you know, my heart is open. There's no going back. This feels different when I want to explore it. And I think that's where a lot of times we say, what's really the center of where the heart and the soul and the spirit? Do we need to wait to have a heart attack to have something, you know, wake us up? Do we need to realize how closed off we might have been? And now we're going to change the world, right? So, I mean, that's a real good example how illness, you know, illness and these physical things can kind of like smack you in the head and say, here's your contrast. What are you going to do with it?
Yes, I think you can. Now, you've just explored the heart as both physical part of the body and also as a metaphor or an image for what we experience emotionally, especially. You can do the same with every part of the body. You could say, let's say you have problems with your feet, as I do too. Then you can explore that and say, well, does this have to do with traveling or moving around or being, reaching out and being in the world more? You can use any part of your body. Some are more difficult. Like I would imagine if I had problems with the pancreas, I'd have to really work at it to find the metaphors. I'm sure they're there.
Right.
But the heart is pretty obvious. Like we have a heart on a Valentine's Day card. That heart gets sick. You know, that heart gets sick. And there's a relationship between that heart and the physical heart. It's not easy to sort all those things out, but we can do it nevertheless.
You know, I think we talk about in medicine and how it's really being challenged these days. Even physicians, we've spoken about it on the radio many times, the suicide risk right now for physicians is extremely high, even so for medical students. And what we're finding is that they're just, medicine people are starting to come to the awareness that it might not be exactly what we thought it was or the savior that it might have been, savior in the white coat. And I think as a collective, we're being challenged to these questions, and it just seems to be hitting different professions now in different ways, and they're taking it and saying, being challenged in their own ways, how do we change it? You know, you talk in your book about the soul of medicine, you say society is not set up to care for the soul. And, you know, I had this discussion on Twitter the other day with some physicians, and they were like, oh, well, the patient wants this, the patient wants that, and the patient wants me to tell them what to eat. The patient wants me to tell me about poisons in their environment. The patient wants to tell me how to detox. They want to tell me this, that, and the other. And it's like we're asking so much of some people that the weight of healthcare and taking care of us is what we expect is too much. I think we really need to step back and say, what can we take care of our own self? How can we explore it on our own and figure things out and work through that versus always walking into the doctor and saying something's broken, this thing that I walked in here with, this vehicle of my human being, you need to fix it on all realms and you've got the answers. So here's my insurance card. And I think that's where we're getting stuck right now because we see a lot of suicide now and we see a lot of people screaming, where's the mental health? Where's this? Where's that? You know, and we want some entity outside of us to be able to have all the answers that we are looking for, don't you think?
Well, I'd like to suggest another way of looking at it. I agree completely with what you just said, but at the same time, I think one of the problems is that even the way we imagine medicine, it is so materialistic. It's all about the body,
correct.
And you learn about body parts. And we evidence-based medicine, you don't really have to have a deep imagination of being of yourself as a healer. You mm-hmm. see yourself more as an encyclopedia of information than someone who has some physical skills. And that's not enough. We have a history in the West, and we have examples all over the world of people who heal others, who are doctors, you might say, who are also spiritual leaders at the very same time. And their treatments are not just physical. They are deeply imagistic, and they address the soul and spirit of the person. I think that if doctors were doing that, if they were really being healers and had a bigger and deeper sense of what their profession is, I don't think they'd be tempted to suicide or being complaining about people
right.
asking too many questions.
Right.
I think I'd love to, if I were a physician who was a real physician, you know, in that bigger sense, I'd love to just explore questions with people all the time. And if they ask some very simple questions that really could be more complex, I would teach
right.
them. I would show them that there's more to what they're asking about, that it's much richer and much more interesting.
Right, which is what I do. You know, I do that all the time, you know, and I think sometimes we really want to have the pill, or people will say to me, you know, something's wrong and my regular doctor can't fix me and you need to fix me and I'm going on a cruise in a week, so here's a check. Do whatever we need to do. And it's like, you know, that's a whole other ball of an example. But definitely it's about the quick fix is really, there isn't, but there's really about being able to honor the exploration. So really what I call a soul doctor is more someone who is willing, to be able to walk with you along your journey and to guide you as you ask and to say, oh, is that a blue light? And we'll say, it could be blue. It could be pale blue. It could be red blue. You know what I'm saying? In other words, to offer other options and to be able to say, how can we walk through this life guided? And say, when things come up, I'll be here. My hand is here for support. But also, too, I'm still behind you and I'm still around you if you should feel like you need to fall. I think that's what people are really looking for. They're really looking for that sense of something around them, something to hold themselves together to say it'll be a soft fall. And that's really where spirit and spirituality come in, and, you know, your religion or whatever that might be. However, there's this little gap where we're saying, I'm not sure if I can trust it. So that's really where people, I think, are resonating these days. Yeah?
I have a parallel to that in my own experience. I've been a psychotherapist for 30 years. I don't do therapy in the way it's usually imagined, you know, in the
mm-hmm.
profession. So I really do more of a soul guidance.
Right.
But still, I know that people will want to put me into a particular box where
mm-hmm.
I have answers, and they have certain things they want to resolve in their life, their specific issues. But
mm-hmm.
I don't allow myself to be limited that way. So
right.
when someone comes to me, let's say they want to, you know, resolve a relationship matter that they're
uh-huh.
dealing with, I go right into their whole life, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And go try to go deep and explore everything that's going on in a big way. And I don't try to be this distant professional who's not engaged. You know, I try to engage
mm-hmm. right.
and let them see me as a person. Not going
yeah.
too far where I say, you know, that can be too much, but enough so that we're not in this extremely formal relationship. So in my own way, I try to do what I'm talking about with the doctors, that mm-hmm. doctors could have a different sense of who they are, have a deeper sense of what they're doing, and I don't think they would be so depressed. I mean, the last figure I saw, 50% of doctors would like to quit.
Yes, it's getting high this year.
Mm-hmm. It's not a good sign. It's not that we can change the physical aspect of the world now, but
mm-hmm.
we could change our attitudes toward what we're doing.
Well, I think when they say they want to quit, I think what they're saying is that they want to quit the way it's being done. What I want to do is I want to quit the way that it's going on. I know that there's something better out there. A lot of physicians have been leaving practices or writing books, you know, my bipolar life, my depression life, my leaving medicine life. And really what they're saying is that it just doesn't fit anymore. I know it's myself, you know, as a naturopathic physician. It was all about, you know, even though that is an all-encompassing profession, it was still about supplements and all this other stuff. And I'm like, you know, no more, you know, and I just dropped it. You know, I just had to totally let it go for many years and say, that isn't it. And, you know, I think sometimes we need to say, honor our experience. So if our experience says, that's not working for me anymore, say, oh, cool, fantastic. Now what's next? And be able to explore the next thing versus saying, I'm so rigid in it, it has to work, and why won't it? Because then we come up with anger things. We come up with fighting against things and with resistance. So when we come up with that resistance sometimes, that will bring us to a point where eventually something will break and we'll figure it out. However, I kind of like to just do the ease one. I kind of like to say, oh, cool, what's next, you know?
Well, you made an excellent point there that it's not that people want to quit being doctors. They don't want to keep doing what they're doing because they feel so diminished by it.
Right.
They really can't be the doctor that they imagined when they started out. They're, you know, pushing pills or they're just delivering information that someone has given them. There's not much creativity in that. And not an opportunity to be that compassionate, caring person either, which motivates many people to get into that kind of profession. So that's a symptom of the society as a whole.
Yeah.
And one of the points I make in this book on aging is that it's difficult to age well today because of the society being so literal and materialistic and physical. There's so much more to life than that. And if you can expand beyond that, then you have a chance of aging with happiness and a feeling of satisfaction. But if you surrender to this world the way it is now, then you're going to be depressed about it all because that material life you have is not going to do so well. It's something else that's going to come into fruition, but it's not the purely physical. So we've got to shift. In order to age well, we have to shift out. I tell people you've got to resist the culture in order to age well or to live a more soulful life. You have to resist. You can't just allow yourself to slip into the culture as the way it is presented. You don't have to resist it 100%. You can participate in the best of it. There's a lot of many wonderful aspects to it. But There is a need for some kind of resistance and say, I am not going to participate in this.
Yeah. You know, I think it's about being able to say, there is so much more out there and I'm willing to do that. You know, it's interesting when people will say, oh, well, I think I'm going to move to a foreign country when I retire, and they get there and they're the happiest they've ever been. It's because sometimes what they've done is they've just closed the book on what they thought life was, and they now said, oh, I'd like to take that leap and see what my next life will be like, you know, and they start enjoying it, or they go to a different country and the rules and the patterns and society in that area in which they are is different, and they love to engage in it. So really, I think what really happens is we get stuck in the paradigm in which in the place where physical place in which we're standing or landing, you know. And we kind of say, oh, this is the way it is. And we really have the opportunity now to be able to expand more in the area we're in, don't you think?
That's a very interesting point. It's not just moving to another place that might give you a new start and be in a new place. But you might even do it in some other way. You might move to a new house. You might take a different job, live in a different place, go on an extended vacation somewhere. There are many ways that we can renew and get out of that world that has become a prison for us. It doesn't have to be quite so dramatic as moving to another country, although that would be probably very effective. I was just recently in Ireland, and I go there frequently, and I do that. I go to Ireland two or three times a year in order to get away from the mm-hmm. culture that I'm in to have a different experience. And I met some Americans there who had done that. They had decided to move permanently to Dublin from New York. And I felt they were doing just what you were describing. They were finding, they were excited about a new world and a new life. And the old things that had bothered them so much they had left behind, they had an opportunity to start from scratch. And that was terrific.
Now let's talk about anger, because people are saying, you know, I'm really PO'd about this. And well, that's the resistance and the fight where you're not, you're seeing that you want to make a change, or you know that there's something different, but you're, it's kind of like you're reverberating against this invisible wall, you know? And it's almost like the soul is really knows that there's more, but it's kind of saying, okay, we want to shatter your beliefs about your past. We want to let it all go. We see anger with, I know I need to make a change, but I really can't. And we see people getting very, very angry. Or we see people with their life is they have a health condition, and then they're like, oh, you know, they get very angry with that. Like they feel like a life was taken away from them. You know, I think all of these ideas is really about what is anger. And how does it play a part in someone that's aging? And, you know, and then we see it, it's also a beginning to many people saying, noticing that they're starting to forget things. So it comes before Alzheimer's and dementia quite often. It definitely comes before a heart attack or a stroke. So really anger is kind of the thing saying, wake up, wake up, wake up. And I'm reverberating, trying to get you to pay attention. And all of a sudden, crack. Here you go. Here comes something. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, anger is complicated, but I simplify it this way, that there are many reasons people feel angry. As they get older, they get frustrated and for many reasons. And also, to be angry sometimes will let them know that there's something wrong. They're angry about something, and something needs to be changed. That's one side, so I think we can trust anger that way and listen to it closely. And if you're helping an older person, help them tell the story of their anger so we know what it's about. That can be absolutely essential. But there's also a kind of anger, there's another kind altogether that I see, as a therapist especially, and that is that people often have anger that goes way, way back in their history. So they may still be angry at something that happened in their childhood or in their adolescence or in their youth. And so it's very, that's why sometimes it's so important to tell the story, the stories of what happened when you were younger, because that anger has got to be worked through. It can be done 50 years later. It can be still be worked through. And you can be relieved of the burden of that anger by through telling the story to someone who will listen closely to what you have to say and help you gain some insight into it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, and especially when we get into that last, per se, third of our life, an estimated value, we say, oh my gosh, you know, we start feeling like we didn't do this or we didn't do that, and all of those things start to weigh on our heads. And even so, I've even seen people when they start to, you know, with some Alzheimer's, people will tell you a story from the past, and really you go, holy crap, where did that come from? I didn't know that that was in their lineage. And then that starts bringing up family conflicts, you know. So I think a lot of times, a lot of storytelling can be kind of risky for many elders, because they say, I might say something, I have to be careful because I don't want them to know the real me. I don't want them to know the real story. And I'm going to write all my secrets down and put it in a little envelope, and they can't open it until I'm dead, and then they can have at it, you know. So I think a lot of times people say, do I take this to my deathbed? Do I let it just become me and who I am, and this is the way it's going to be? And maybe next time when I come back in the lifetime, I could live a different story, you know, because so many are so stuck by the guilt and the shame and the pain of the past that they really are just, it's almost so ingrained from them. They feel like that if they let it go, that their whole world would just shatter. And then we all know the story of loneliness and being alone and being aged, correct?
Yes, loneliness is a big complaint among people who are getting older. Again, I have a couple different ways of looking at that and writing about it. One is that I think we can deal with loneliness better not by having a lot of people around. Just having a number of people doesn't necessarily resolve loneliness, but to be able to have closer connections with people and places. Your loneliness may not just be for other people. It may be for a place or for objects. You have to know what your loneliness is. That's why it's also important to tell the story of your loneliness, to know what it's all about, and respond from your heart. It's a soul issue. So you can't just have people around. You have to have kind of connection that wakens your soul. It's a deep connection. Another thing, too, I think, this is a little more obscure, but I think if we look at the idea of loneliness really closely, we might see that it's asking us to be more ourselves, to be our own selves, to be alone in that sense. Loneliness leading to aloneness, to being somebody who is not like everybody else. I think it's very important as we get older that we realize very strongly that we are individuals and not like everyone else. And we can be free of trying to be normal and be fit in with everyone and be more relaxed about being our own eccentric selves. I think that's a big part of being, of growing older, to accept that individuality.
Mm-hmm. You know, I also think, you know, a lot of times when people talk about loneliness, I really feel it as a disconnect of the vital force. In other words, we're all energetic beings, and many people drift off and aren't quite energized by a human touch or human engagement. I know my husband, he sells life insurance, and I said to him one day, I said, "Do you know what your real job is?" He said, "Yeah, it's to connect with people, because some of these people, I'm the only person they see all month when I come to collect their payment." You know, so I really find that loneliness is a disconnect from that hear, feeling, sensing, touching another human being that lets me know that I'm still valid and I'm still here and I'm still alive. You know, sometimes loneliness can almost feel like you're drifting off. It's almost like a dimmer switch on the light, you know. And if someone comes over to visit you, you turn the light back up again and you feel energized, you know. You open up the windows, you start to get dressed up, you have something on the table to eat. So I think really that idea of how can we bring energy back into people's lives is so essential these days, yes?
Well, it's not just that we are communal people, that we need each other in community, and that's absolutely, you know, true. We do need to be part of family and community. Mm-hmm. But we are also friendship people. Mm-hmm. Friendship is so important. So, and that doesn't have to be literal. I'm not just talking about having friends that you've known for years and years. You have an encounter with someone who's helping you, an insurance person or someone cutting your hair or something like that.
Right.
You have some time to sit there and talk with them. The model of that relationship at that moment is friendship. Not deep, lasting friendship, but a friendly encounter. And those things are really important. It always amazes me to watch how people who don't know each other can suddenly come together. They might just be sitting next to each other on a plane, and they get involved in a really probing conversation. And the way I would look at it is that is a therapeutic conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps people who are lonely to be open to that kind of thing and to use friendship as your model for relating, and make sure that every relationship you have and every encounter you have can be more than superficial. And I think that would help the loneliness that you feel.
Yeah, it really is a challenge for so many people these days. We hear it quite often, social media. Well, Thomas, in closing, can we just touch on the topic of, spirituality of aging? We've really talked about it this whole time, but really about, what do, in our last times, people kind of say, well, is my religion, how do we bounce between religion and hope and spirituality? And are we really leaving it all behind? And what's that great leap going to be? So many are, I have so many people that I know, and I even have some clients, they would do anything and they would spend their last dime to be able to stay in this world because they had such a great fear, of taking that leap. I mean, they were just, there was no way that they were going to take a leap. They weren't going to, they were just, save me at all costs. This is what it's going to be. And I think we see others who are like, okay, I'm done. Where's my exit door?
Right.
And I'm ready to go. So I think that's a great challenge between religion, hope, and spirituality. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's really very, very important. I think that we had, it's a big question. We had religion for most of us, probably. As I said, I'm 77. I grew up in a very traditional, highly institutionalized Catholic church.
Right.
And that's not the way I live today. But that was how I grew up, and many people have. I think one of the tasks for people as they get older today, not everybody, but most people probably, is to reassess and learn more about that religion that was part of their life, or that mm-hmm. may still be. If you want to age well, and as you were suggesting, die well, you really have to have a spiritual capacity. You have to be able to imagine life in a big way that's quite positive and supportive. I think you have to redo your formal religion. If that's where you are, you have to bring it up to date for yourself. You're now an adult. You can't just live on your childhood religion. You have to be mm-hmm. adult about it. That's one thing. The other thing is today in this world, you don't have to stay with one religion. You can get a great deal from exploring many different traditions today. I don't mean that you're going to find out which is the right one for you. I mean getting some wisdom and some hints from each religious tradition. I think that you can even maintain your own tradition and fill it in with some of the insights from other religions and spiritual movements. So we're living in a time today when you can be spiritual in such a rich way. It's a shame that we have so many people that are the way you describe them,
right.
Not having really explored the spiritual life deeply enough to have that support as they get older. But I think mm-hmm. there's so much we could do. And that's certainly what I've dedicated my life to mainly, is to try to help people reimagine their spiritual life so that it will give them support as they get older.
Yeah, I also grew up in the Catholic Church, and, when I was from the age of, third grade until I was 18, I used to play the pipe organ, and sing the Latin Mass with the priest. And I'll never forget the day that one day they turned the altar around and they brought a guitar in the church, and I went, oh, that is so not going to work. And I took all of the mystery and the mystery and the suspense out of the church, and I went, oh, but we were speaking in Latin and we were giving you a mystery of something that was something bigger than yourself, and now you made it into this other thing that I don't know what it is. So I think that sometimes we say, can we let go of always having the answers and be able to create more mystery in our lives, too? In other words, where we're going after we die is a great mystery. There isn't printed down answers for us. So can we allow ourselves to engage in mystery in the end of our life and exploration versus saying, I know all the answers, and here's all my pieces of paper, and this is how I'm going to die? We all hear about the good death. I work with a lot of palliative care physicians, and they're like, well, this is the way it's going to be, and we're going to do all this, this, and this, and it's all of a sudden, boom, the next day, didn't go that way at all. So, you know, I think what do we have control of or what we don't have control of? That's really what aging is about exploring the mystery of life versus having control over it, right?
Yes, and we can prepare for that mystery of death by living the mystery that is part of life from the very beginning. So the mystery of birth, that's also very mysterious. And it's good to think about it and then reflect on it. And the mystery of marriage, it's such a terrific mystery. I mean, you know, it's not a very easy, logical arrangement. It's a great mystery. And the mystery of the work that you do, how do you make sense of your life and giving so much effort and time to the work you do? So that we are, our life is full of mysteries. And if we could only see them as such and relate to them that way, I think we'd be better prepared for the great mystery of dying.
Right. Instead of saying this is the answers and I got to find them, right?
That's right. There's no answer. Yeah. So as you were saying, there's no answer. And if you live a life where you must have answers, you're not going to be happy with the end.
No. No. Well, Thomas, it was such a wonderful time talking to you today. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been a great time.
It's wonderful to have a conversation like this.
Oh, thank you so much. Would you like to share with the listeners how to find out more information about you? That'd be wonderful.
Yes, my most recent book is Ageless Soul, and it's available everywhere. And my website is thomasmooresoul.com, thomasmooresoul.com. And I'd be happy to hear from people.
It would be absolutely wonderful. We'll have to have you on another time, maybe about with one of your other books. So we just love having conversations with you.
Well, thank you very much. That would be great.
Thank you. Have a great day. If you'd like to find out more information about Thomas More and his book, again, is Ageless Soul, The Lifelong Journey Toward Meaning and Joy, please just check out the link on the bottom of today's show page and go directly to his website. And really, it's just about the exploration, the joy, and the mystery of life, rather than saying, you know, I got it all nailed down and this is the way you have to do it. Enjoy your moments. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Thank you so much for joining us today. Till tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.